show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Back the 28th day of October 2013. This is The Horn. I am Bob Kincaid, and we begin a brand new broadcast week here at The Horn. We put pay to October this week. Yep, Thursday that'll be. And in the course of that effort, we will be, of course, trying to raise the typical $150 per evening. And thank you very kindly for those of you who have contributed thus far this month. We have only 4 days to go to start all over again. It's not exactly a business model. It's a model, but not a business model. It's a community maintenance model is what it is. And so we're looking for 15 people at $10 a piece, 10 people at $15 a piece, any combination thereof to keep us out of the hole as we go through tonight and head for tomorrow. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It is, and you know it, and I know it too, we know exactly what day it is here. If for no other reason than it falls after the weekend, this, by God, is More In Monday.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know. More.
Huh. Well, isn't that interesting? That's new. Used to be I could play two tracks over one another, but the More In's got me again. Yes, indeed. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. It's More In Monday on the Horn. We've got More Ins for you. Right Wing More Ins, Teabag and More Ins, Repiglick and More Ins, Grand Old More Ins, More Ins of every stripe, Libertarian More Ins, Masquerading More Ins, More Ins, More Ins everywhere. You can't tell the More Ins without a program, and this is the program that tells the More Ins. You just can't tell them much. That's right. For less than 5 cents per hour of programming, you can. In fact, you will. And we're not exactly barring your access if you don't. Peer behind this thin veil of cybernetic canvas at all manner of morons. A little warning to folks going through the door. Hang on to your purses. Hang on to your wallets. Hang on to your kids. Hang on to your hats. The morons can get a little grabby. They are, after all, conservatives and not to be trusted with the family silver, the family candelabrum, or just about anything else that's portable. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in morons. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And how true. Our lead moron this evening struck a bit close to home earlier today. Got up this morning and my email began beeping at me. A number of folks sending me a link to an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. No, the op-ed writer in the Washington Post is not a moron. The op-ed writer in the Washington Post is, in fact, pointing toward moronity. And what moranity it is. Thank you. Thank you, Randy, pointing out. Got loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac. Good, good, good. And just a reminder, we're broadcasting live. No, this is an ongoing experiment. We're broadcasting live both on the Horn stream and sending out audio via the Horn's Ustream channel as well. So whichever way suits you best, you are more than welcome to participate however you choose. Now, Moran Monday. Like I said, it's not the op-ed in the Washington Post that is Moranic. It is the subject of the writing in the Washington Post that is Moranic. Many of you may recall, especially those of you who have been with the Horn family commune for a while, the disaster that transpired the Upper Big Branch mine, where Don Work Like You Mean It Blankenship put corporate profits ahead of worker safety, just like he had at the Arakoma mine, and just like the International Coal Group had up at the Widowmaker. Oh, what was the name of it? How quickly in northern West Virginia. A bad year. Bad couple of years. 29 miners were incinerated at the Upper Big Branch mine, you might recall. And, it was Mark Levin, that man with the voice made for print the other day. We had audio of him pontificating about how that Kenyan Muslim socialist is trying to shut down our mines. Yeah, you recall that? I do. Well, it turns out that my theory that we need to waste no time in getting In God We Trust off the currency and replacing it with Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal's aphorism, the business of America is business. We really can't waste any more time, especially with a story like this. Now, as background, and I suppose the loved ones of people who are on police forces or fire departments, heaven knows the loved ones of people who serve in the military and whose loved ones are overseas in some godforsaken conflict we never should have been involved in the first place, know the same sort of fear that the loved ones of an underground coal miner know. It is the fear that at any point in time, because of the inherently dangerous nature of the activity engaged in, and you know, the same thing goes for working people, construction workers, laborers. You never know what you just assume that your loved one's coming home that day, but sometimes it doesn't happen that way, and you instead see your entire universe turned upside down. Such was the case for the families of the 29 miners incinerated at the Upper Big Branch mine. Enter Cedar Amusements of Sandusky, Ohio. They run amusement parks like King's Dominion. And it is, after all, Halloween season, isn't it? And at Halloween, we do things that every community has its little haunted house where you have to wear a blindfold and stick your hand in a bowl of Jell-O or a bowl of spaghetti and you know, the black olives or eyeballs and it creeps out the 9-year-olds and everybody has a good time. So, like I said, enter King's Dominion Amusement Park in what the editorial, the op-ed at Washington Post refers to as in the rolling Virginia countryside about 70 miles south of Washington, D.C. Anything for a dollar. The pitch this Halloween at King's Dominion, 70 miles south of Washington, D.C., is as follows. Alone in the darkness, the only sound is the pulsing of your heart as the searing heat slowly boils you alive. It was reported to be the worst coal mine accident in history. The families of missing miners begged for help, but it was decided that a rescue was too dangerous.
the miners were left entombed deep underground. Lamps at their sides and pickaxes in their hands, they're searching for the men who left them to die, waiting to exact their revenge. That is the ad for Miner's Revenge, a terror maze at King's Dominion in Virginia. A terror maze that trades on the real horrors of real families and the miseries, the grief. Did I say horrors? That the families of over 100,000 American citizens have endured since about 1900. And the families of 29 men in particular over the last 4 years. It was April 5th, 2010, when Massey Energy's Upper Big Branch mine exploded in a storm of methane gas and dust and capitalism. The worst coal mine disaster in 40 years. It turns out that Massey Energy, since purchased by Alpha Natural Resources, had almost too many safety violations at Upper Big Branch to be able to count. And there has been a steady parade from low to higher of Massey suits and foremen who are now cooling their heels in some federal penitentiary system. Many people hereabouts are still waiting for the day of glory when a grand jury returns indictments against Don Blankenship, whose merciless quest for profit killed those 29 men. Of the 29 killed at Upper Big Branch, the remains, the editorial notes, of one miner were not found for days. That's because he had been blown into the ceiling, and all the rescuers were looking around on the ground. Five miners were so burnt up that there wasn't enough lung tissue to test to find out if they had what's called coal workers' pneumoconiosis, but is known to folks hereabouts as black lung. Black lung helped kill my grandfather. That's why I only knew him till I was 5 years old. Tommy Davis is quoted in the op-ed. He says, "I felt this wind and all this shit coming out, rocks and wood. I made it outside and was trying to get my bearings. I thought it was a major rock fall, but I remember them all back there. My son, my brother, my nephew, and the others." Davis' son, Corey, his brother, Timmy, and his nephew, Joseph Knapper, all were killed that day. Another miner who survived had to leave miners who did not, who were beginning to die from carbon monoxide poisoning. One woman described how she found out that she had lost her son in the Upper Big Branch disaster. At first, mine officials told her that her son was okay. Then they came to her later and said, and had a group of folks around and said, if I call your name, go over to Whitesville Fire Department and identify the body. Her 33-year-old son, Gary Wayne, the father of two, was among the names called. Go over and identify the body. Now, of course, an outfit as big as the folks that run King's Dominion, they've got a paid PR hack flack who was interviewed for this. And he said, Miner's revenge is not designed nor intended to depict a specific situation. We express our deepest sympathy to the victims and their families of that real-life blast. Well, you can extend your sympathies to the victims of that real-life blast all you want to, Mr. Petrillo, but they're busy being dead. But that's okay. Because if an American corporation can't profit off of the agony and misery and horror of American families, well, the terrorists win, don't they? If an American company can't make $32, and that is, in fact, what it costs to get in so you can go through the miners' revenge maze, well, what good's having a constitution or freedom? Really? The business of America is business. And them 29 miners are dead. Least they can do is help us make a buck on the quarterly profit and loss statement, ain't it? I prefer to think that this story is so odious, and since it was published on the op-ed page of the Washington Post, that it will get sufficient. I'm sure somebody at the Rachel Maddow Show or Lawrence, what's his name, or maybe Big Ed or somebody is out there furiously scripting an absolutely brilliant television package to talk about how odious this all is. And I would like to think that maybe there will be enough coverage that King's Dominion will be shamed into closing it down. Or at least rearranging it and stop calling it the Miner's Revenge and stop pitching stories about human beings abandoned in blasted, blown-up coal mines. You see, that's our reality here. It was just a couple of weeks ago I was telling you about one disaster that transpired in 1915, maybe 10 miles from here. And this whole state is dotted with places where that happened. Monongah in, 1907, when more than 300 men died, and the coal company executive finally gave in and gave the widows $70 apiece to cover the losses, to somehow repay them for their profiteering capitalistic ways, having deprived these working people, these working men, of their very lives. They coughed up $70 per widow, and the mine executive said, because this happened in December of 1907, the mine executive said, well, that ought to make a pretty good Christmas for some of these people. I have a cousin who survived one of those things. I remember him telling me all about his ordeal one August evening on the front porch of what had once been a coal company house just a few miles from here. Because he had survived, he had been invited on to Tell the Truth, the game show. Why not? The business of America is business. And doing Moran things is the business of morons. Now, the Miner's Revenge is only one of 10 haunted attractions that are there at King's Dominion. So you'd think they could cut it down and maybe make it 9. But that's how it is in America, where one family's horror a few years on, or 29 families' horrors a few years on, can be used to give a spine-tingling good time to families desperate for stimulation in the rolling hills of Virginia, 70 miles south of our nation's capital. And of course, we're numb, aren't we? We are vastly, as a people, we are vastly overstimulated. Not you, I don't think. Not the Horn Family Commune. We engage in pretty reasonable dialogue for the most part, except for the occasional moments when I go into a screaming hissy fit, and those are not, you know, those just happen. But for the most part, this country goes reeling from one honey boo boo to a duck dynasty. Pick it. Just looking, always looking to pathetically live vicariously through someone else's existence. And that's not to say it's necessarily bad, but anything taken immoderately becomes bad. Moderation in all things, the ancient Greeks used to say. These are the same people who gave us theatrical events where Oedipus would walk back on stage having just blinded himself, having found out that he was the source of the plague that was besetting Thebes because he had angered the gods by marrying his mommy and having youngins by her. But that was over in 3 or 4 hours. And yes, there was a vicarious thrill of horror to that. And that's on display every slasher movie, every zombie flick, every chainsaw-wielding horror movie. Sure. And we've got a word for it. It's called catharsis. And there's there are reams of scholarly papers written on the willing suspension of disbelief and the cleansing function of catharsis. But when you get to a point in a culture where the agonies of 29 families, and when I say 29 families, I'm talking about 29 mamas, 29 daddies, 29 wives, 29 or more cousins, aunts, uncles, sons, daughters, so that it multiplies out in such a way that everybody in a community gets touched by something like this. When you multiply that out and you find that, well, this story is making the rounds in the southern part of the state and probably the northern part of the state as well. Oddly enough, I haven't heard Cecil Roberts, president of the United Mine Workers of America, say anything about it yet. Nor have I heard Senator Joe Manchin, who gets pissed off over T-shirts from Abercrombie and Fitch, but has yet to say anything. And he got real bent out of shape about, what was it, Book Wild? That reality television show on MTV? Anybody want to just do a quick run, just a quick lap around the internet and see if Baloney Joe has put out any scathing press releases yet? Dr. John with an observation. He says, miners' revenge? Jesus! How many times can a corporation earn a buck off the hide of coal miners? It happened all during their lives and then at their death, and now it's continuing after their deaths. The worst part here? There's no revenge at all. Just like there's no pie in the sky when you die. You can't take revenge on a corporation, an inanimate creation. It's deathless and untouchable because too many people skim a bit of money off its operation. No revenge for the dead. They're simply being used as props for people who consume the coal while being blissfully content that they bear no responsibility for the conditions of its extraction. And why is that? Dr. John is absolutely right, of course. Why is that? Because these people who are oblivious are busy being overstimulated by Honey Boo Boo Chow and the Walking Dead and that science teacher turned meth maker and on and on and on. And yeah, sure, into the bargain, let's throw the NFL, college football, hockey, basketball, the World Series. Overstimulated. And so they don't have time to sit around and think about the fact that just like meat doesn't come from the refrigerator case at the grocery store, electricity doesn't come from the wall socket. No, no, electricity comes from places like the Upper Big Branch mine, and that electricity comes from, oh, where else? How about was it Valley Grove? West Virginia, where a responsible, an environmentally responsible fracking company called MarkWest completely flooded a family's little home. Now, when we talk about West Virginia, we don't necessarily, I don't want to create, yeah, sure, this is often a state whose theme songs are played in minor keys. But we got some nice real estate around here. There are mansions that sit on the tops of the mountains overlooking Charleston, West Virginia's Kanawha Valley that would compare favorably to anything going on in Beverly Hills, California. And there are McMansions outside Morgantown, West Virginia that would simply take your breath away. But when a house gets ruined by a fracking company, odds are it's not going to be one of those homes. It's going to be a home much more like this. 1,000 square feet, 80 years old, maybe once upon a time a coal company house. This one never was. Not a damn dime of coal money ever went into the creation of this home. But it will have seen its better days, and it will be the worse for wear. And hell, maybe when it rains, it'll rain in the bedroom. Doing that right now, as a matter of fact. And that's the kind of house that gets ruined by the frackers. Sergi with a note. Oxymorons, environmentally responsible fracking company. Wow, talk about the mother of oxymorons. That one is simply too offensive to make a joke about. It was, apparently, West Virginia Day at the Washington Post, because in addition to having this op-ed on their op-ed pages about these profiteering... Word, anybody, please, capitalists, at King's Dominion, the front page, and Dr. Bill clued me into this, the front page contained an article about how West Virginia is turning from a blue state, a rock-solid blue state, into a red state. And, of course, it featured the obligatory quotes from people talking about a war on coal. And about how down in one pathetic county that has seen the tender mercies of the coal industry for 120 years, how they finally managed to put a Ten Commandments rock on their courthouse lawn and they're daring anybody to come take it away. Because it's all they got left. They see coal company jobs disappearing, and the coal companies provide them a convenient scapegoat because they're just covering their asses for when they do leave. The coal company says, well, see, it's that Obama war on coal. All the while they rake in the cash, all the while mining employment goes down, all the while the reserves are depleted, and it's just a matter of, you know, Cletus, just keep hollering war on coal till we got everything packed up and we're ready to leave. And then we'll laugh all the way out of state and all the way to the bank. Sure. Why not? I wanted to share something with you also that Dr. John sent along because he was listening to Dr. Bill between 4 and 6 this evening. And Dr. Bill was talking about social responsibility and the right-wing model versus the sort of liberal left-wing model, although it's not very left-wing. It's not like communism or anything. Ooh, scary. Communism. Subject line, right-wing Twitter creepiness. Wow, Bob, I just saw with my own eyes what Dr. Bill's been talking about how the right wing has a plan to demolish the separation of powers. And they do, you know, and they're really serious about it. John Darnielle, lead singer of the Mountain Goats, whom you've played before, and whom I've listened to even more. Awesome group. Makes a habit of trolling anti-choice GOP lawmakers and throwing actual facts at them. So he called out Ted Cruz after Cruz said something asinine about the Texas ruling today. You know, there's a ruling by a real live, honest-to-God federal judge today that said the whole Texas assault on women and their women folk reproductive systems was unconstitutional. You know, again, the Constitution, not legal, you know. And John notes, then the right-wing Twitterers came out in force saying, among other things, there's no guarantee of abortion rights in the Constitution. Darnielle naturally replies, well, the Supreme Court says otherwise, and always will. To which one nasty little right-winger replied, well, the Supreme Court won't always have the last word. Dr. John notes, chilling. And yeah, that's the playbook, isn't it? That's not the first time that we've heard that sort of thing. I think Mark Levin himself declared that the Supreme Court is not the last word, that he would amend the Constitution so that the states could overturn the Supreme Court in acts of rank nullification whenever the spirit moved them. Also, before the program went to air, I had a note from Ron in Raleigh. He says, a couple of weeks ago, I pointed to a meme that keeps showing up in letters to the editor and comment sections on websites. I'm linking to a letter in my local paper that is a prime example of this meme. I would guarantee that the letter writer is, in her opinion, a devout Bible-believing Christian. As I've said before, the Republican Party has found the sweet spot in the American psyche of venality, mendacity, stupidity, just added, and selfishness, and just plain old-fashioned meanness. This is a letter to the editor from Becky Mann, that's M-A-N-N, Mann, of Raleigh. The October 20th news article, North Carolina health insurance rates among nation's highest, clarified much. The main thing I got was that those of us who have chosen to work two jobs if necessary and pay our way are going to carry the rest of the nation for Obamacare in the form of subsidies for those who choose paths that do not take care of their financial needs or who just choose not to work. It's just another so-called entitlement program. Unlike Social Security and Medicare, which we have paid into, this program will subsidize people like the Lenharts, 53 and 55, who choose to run an elderberry farm and make only $20,000 a year, meaning they'll pay nothing for insurance. That's why Nancy Mize, an optometrist, must pay twice as much as her current plan or go with a bit cheaper plan with a much higher deductible in order to subsidize the Lenharts, who obviously have no reason not to pursue additional employment to pay for their own health care without subsidies. I'm fed up with keeping up able-bodied people who just need to get off their butts and go to work. You see, some work is more valid than others. An optometrist in the world of Becky Mann is much more valid labor than is the labor of someone who tills the earth and tends the elderberry bushes. And because, you know, who needs elderberries? Ain't there a corporation out there growing some elderberries? I mean, so what if they've been genetically modified elderberries and they got the they got the gene of the rectum of a python in it or something? I mean, I'm sure they still good elderberries. How come them people got to grow the elderberries? They're 53 and 55. Ain't they got enough sense to go get a job at the Rippy Mart or the Walmart where they ain't going to have no health insurance in the first place? I'm tired of subsidizing these lazy butts who won't go get a job that I approve of. Yep. This is a nation in the full flower, the toxic blossoming of its own self-loathing. And it just goes on and on. But I think we need at least a little bit of a funny. You're familiar with Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry? Probably the most famous of all of Bob Marley's songs. I love nothing better than a good parody. And this here is a good parody. This is a parody of No Woman, No Cry, discussing the fact, or discussing the injustice, I guess, of, well, no, I don't guess, it is an injustice, it's sexism, it's, right. It's just hard to, what in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia isn't unjust? I mean, the continued existence of that entire stinking royal family is unjust, but you know, who the hell am I, right? I guess I won't be on the birthday card list for the Royal House of Saud. Oh well. Leave it then. To Hisham Faghi, who is a very brave man. He is a Saudi social activist. And he, you know, he's got the headgear and the flowing robes. And this is, of its sort, genius. Kind of reminds me of the parody that I want to write of Paul McCartney's Blackbird. Change it to Blackburn. Do it about Marcia. Here we go. No Woman, No Drive.
Hello. My name is Hisham Faghi. I'm an artist and social activist. I don't really listen to music, but while studying in the U.S., I heard a song by a Jamaican guy that really caught my attention. I decided to do my own rendition, with lyrics relevant to my culture, but without musical instruments. And now, with the help of some of my talented friends, I sing.
I hope they don't cut his head off for it. And, well, I don't know. Is he in? I don't know if he's in Saudi Arabia, so I'm sure this has already been banned. Thanks to Jeff, very kindly, kicking in to, in support of Dr. Bill's program. Thank you very much, Jeff. It's much appreciated. Dr. John, Ron's email, why do right-wingers hate freedom? Seriously, is there anything closer to what the founders would have considered freedom than people who are small-scale farmers like the elderberry farmers who drew the wrath of that writer? Didn't Jefferson predicate his whole model of the future U.S. on a robust small farming sector? I think that may be rhetorical, but yes, the answer is yes, he did. We were going to have an entire nation of small landholding farmers who were going to be literate and were going to be taught by the rubbish that had been raked, and the country and there was the continent was going to be big enough to be populated unto the 1,000th generation, Jefferson said. So yeah. Dr. John continues, didn't Washington quote the Bible on the virtues of small farmers over 50 times in his letters? Yes. Typical was that to Lafayette upon Washington's retirement when he noted, I am become a private citizen on the banks of the Potomac and under the shadow of my own vine and my own fig tree. Yeah. Of course, I think he neglected to mention the fact that he was being fanned by his own human being in the process, but I'm cranky that way. This lousy right-winger is saying those farmers should go get another job. Isn't that the exact opposite of freedom? To be forced to produce more and more and more despite your desire to succeed according to different criteria? Yes, Dr. John, I'll add, isn't that kind of the definition of Stalinism, where you get your annual quota of elderberries, and if you meet your quota the next year, the state declares you need to produce 10% more elderberries, and if you do that, the next year after that, you have to produce 20% more elderberries on top of that, and if in the fourth year, then you get sent to Siberia, or in this case, corporate America. But there's an undercurrent there. There really is. This woman that whose note Ron passed along has a obviously deep-seated jealousy of somebody having that kind of freedom. Because it is a real freedom. To a certain extent, it is a risky freedom. It is a freedom to starve if you get an early frost. It's a freedom to fail. But it's also the freedom to attempt, at least, to choose your own destiny. It's the freedom of the long winter months when you plan for the backbreaking labors of the sunnier, warmer season. But everything is upside down, backwards, sideways, up is down, night is day. It with these right wingers, they profess freedom, and yet at the same time, they want to declare what is and isn't meaningful labor. And they use things like phrases like confiscatory taxation. I'm sure this woman gets her stupid tri-cornered hat out and takes her takes her Gadsden flag with her wherever she goes. God Almighty. And I mentioned a little bit ago the ruling, and of course it's only an initial ruling, it's a district court ruling. It'll go up through the circuit court, and it'll eventually find its way to the Supreme Court, where the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia, plus or not plus Kennedy, will maybe, for all we know, rule that Texas only passed its restrictive laws regarding women's rights to control the workings of their own bodies because Jesus told them to. And you might think that statement hyperbolic, but it isn't. I give you Steve Schleffler. Probably get some cream to go to the Schleffler cutoff and get out of the car and cut off your Schleffler. A little cream on it. Maybe the Schleffler will stop Schleffling. Steve Schleffler is identified as a conservative Christian activist. And over at BuzzFeed was a report today about how the teabaggers and the ultra-right-wingers and the unrepentant John Bircher types, who are now the teabaggers, instead of running away from Ted, born to be king of America, according to his daddy Cruz, are running to him. Because, yes, Ted Cruz, senator from Texas, is back in Iowa. Which I guess doesn't piss his constituents off, at least the ones that, well, God wants him to be there. It's God's plan for Ted Cruz's life. In Des Moines, Iowa, ...600 people gathered, probably paying, this way to the Egress boys, to see Ted Cruz. 600 people. That's when Steve Schleffler wandered up to the podium to give thanks, you know, to God for Ted Cruz, who cost the government billions upon billions of dollars, who almost single-handedly shut down the United States government, who drove to the very brink of default and caused financial repercussions that will continue to ripple through the workforce for God knows how long. One Iowa Republican operative said, every time one of these guys attacks him, it's good for him, talking about Cruz. He's like a superhero. The more bullets that get shot at him, the better and stronger he gets. Don't worry. It gets worse. But then again, the block, what was it, last spring that the Superman movie came out and everybody noticed that there were rather not very well hidden overtones and comparisons between Superman and Jesus. They even sent out a press packet for on how preachers could preach to their congregations about Jesus' superpowers. Yeah. Steve Schleffler. Hey, son, use the Schleffler call again. I think I can get a beat on him this time. Steve Schleffler announced to those 600 faithful, that he thanked God for Ted Cruz and real leaders like him who were willing, and this is a quote, to be crucified for their belief system. Crucified. You know, just like the followers of Spartacus. You thought I was going. Crucified, just like the pirates who kidnapped Julius Caesar. And yes, crucified, maybe. A man standing up and grandstanding in order to build a fundraising list is the same thing as a human being stripped naked, having nails pounded through his or her flesh. The Romans were rather non-discriminatory in that regard when Marcus Licinius Crassus crucified the followers of Spartacus. Women went up as well as men. Cruz finally spoke to the crowd and said, I am here more than anything else with a word of encouragement, with a word of hope. See, word of encouragement, word of hope, that's fundamentalist code. Because there's a word of hope, a word of encouragement, a word of prophecy, a word of healing, a word of instruction, biblically talk. We are facing extraordinary times, Cruz said. For everyone who talks about wanting to win elections in 2014, particularly an off-year, non-presidential year, nothing matters more than an energized and active and vocal grassroots America. And by grassroots, he means fundamentalist Jesus freaks. Crucified. He's been crucified. I guess that means he's risen again, doesn't it? Yowzer. So, that's where we begin this More In Monday. The phone number, of course, 304-658-3333. On Skype, the contact is Bob Kincaid Horn. If you've never been on Skype with the program before, shoot me a contact request and I will approve it, and then we're off and running. But let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, that was... you took me back to when I was haunting the library when I was a kid, picking up Folkways recordings, and there was a thing called Payday Don't Come to Cold Creek No More. The woman was singing with it, with that special keening voice that is mountains, but I guess it's also related to England, the Scotch sound that people can get. And it was another disaster. And you know something? I don't remember ever... What year did the Big Branch State Trip take place?
2010, April 5th.
Yeah, see, I don't remember a darn thing in the news about it that I can remember.
Oh, Anderson Cooper parachuted in. I think Katie Couric was here, and they all wrung their hands until it wasn't interesting anymore, and they went away.
Yeah. That's
was interesting for as precisely as long as the dead hadn't been found.
Yeah, yeah. I did watch the guys come out of the Bolivian cop. Was a cop of mine, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was a, you know.
I think it was Chilean, wasn't it?
Chilean, you're right. And I'll tell you about something that uplifts you when they were bringing these people out. You just begin to wonder whether it's the way they do things now in certain countries, or because the technology has improved to a point where they can do it. Because those fellas that were down there, they really hung together as a group, you know, and they kept each other going, because that was not an automatic they could save these guys, you know.
Right.
And people are strange. I remember reading about the Battle of Antietam, where the guys that were cleaning up the field afterwards got caught stuffing bodies down somebody's well. That's the way, you know, the burial details. That's wonderful, isn't it? Gee, why does my water taste so funny? Is it me, or is it, you know what? Because I mean, you're...
Yeah, I don't think Timmy and Lassie can do anything about that. What's that, Lassie?
You get so perplexed by human behavior because you're taught from the time you were a kid, like I was, being still raised in that post-World War II glow before Vietnam, you know?
Right.
And we were taught this, that, and the other thing, and as you read and you age... hell, that was a group. I can't think of the Russian general's name, but they captured one Russian guy, the Germans did, during the battle for Moscow, and he ended up leading 100,000 Cossacks and Ukrainians and such who fought wearing German uniforms, and then got sent back at the end of the war. That was a horrific scandal that they were sent back, because they're still... But Churchill was big on that. You know, that was a legal thing to do. But you made me think of another situation. We had a young man who worked. He was a West Virginia citizen, and he worked for either the CNO or the B&O Railroad, and he was injured on the job. And they beat him out of what he probably should have got. You know, I mean, let's face it, Bob. If they can do it, they will.
Oh, sure, and that's why That's why this story about the haunted miners' revenge maze in Virginia just had me fit to be tied, because there are plenty of mines or old mines in this state and in Kentucky and in Virginia where people were left buried alive. I think it was something like 70 were never found at Eccles in the 1920s. Five or so years ago, we found out that the coal company that was working in that area again had started pumping coal sludge down into that old mine. On top of the bodies of those dead miners. Bill? Hey, Bill. Well, we had a kind of a pop there, and then Bill went away, so try back, Bill. Really? I mean, that happens. And it happened. And we tend around here to have long memories. And then, of course, there's Crandall Canyon out in Utah, where the rescuers died, too. I don't know if this story has made it out there to the loved ones of those miners. But, it immediately came to mind for me. Hey, welcome to the program. Okay, something has happened here. I hate it when technology goes sideways on the fly. It's almost like something went south on the board. Weird. We'll get an engineer right on it. Not. All right, let's try this again. Hey, welcome to the program. Huh. All I hear is an echo. That's very strange. I'm sorry, Bill. For some reason or another, assuming that was you calling back, nothing's working. Oh, dear. Might be time to reboot the phone system. So we'll take a little break. You never know what kind of fun you're going to have on any given night. what? Let's take a break and let me see if I can sort this out. This is the horn, listener supported. Looking for those other 14 folks at $10 or 10 people at $14. Either way is fine to help keep us out of the hole here. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Tell them in the country, tell them in the town. The miners down in Mingo laid their shovels down. We won't pull another pillow, load another ton, or lift another finger till the union we have won. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. There's fire in her hearts and fire in her soul, but there ain't gonna be no fire in the hole. I'll bet this coal will kill me before my working days is through. In a hole that's dark and dirty, an early grave confined, I plan to make a union for the ones I leave behind. Stand up, boys, let the bosses know. Turn your buckets over, turn your lanterns low. Far in her heart and far in her soul. But there ain't gonna be no far in the hole. There ain't gonna be no far in the hole.
Dickens. The first one was Fire in the Hole. The second one was Gathering Storm. Give you chills. It really, really will. Kevin and both pointing out, Bob, you heard a pop, but we heard your voice suddenly sound like you were in a jar. And when you tried to go to the phones again, it did it again. And when you disconnected, you sounded fine. So, oh, dear. Makes you wonder which part of the technology's gone sideways and how bad it'll be. I have, meanwhile, rebooted the phone system if anybody wants to give that a try, or if you want to try back, Bill, you know, whatever you might choose. No, Yeah, Isaac's saying maybe you should turn off the Ustream. That's what screws up Nicole's show. Nope, this has absolutely nothing to do with that. It is not possible that that could have something to do with it. Isaac says, Bob, your show is starting to sound and act like the Nicole Sandler show. Well, I think the world of Nicole, and I know she's had some tech difficulties too, but this is actually a fairly high-tech affair. And the two systems, the one that does the streaming and the one that does the audio production, are entirely separate. Let's try this again. Anybody there?
No.
Okay, good. Later.
Yeah, I just had one more quick story. The Germans were recruiting for the SS all over Europe, and they actually had two divisions of Bosnian Muslims that they used. And these guys wore red fezes on dress parade. The kind of stuff you learn that they never teach you about in school, you know?
No, not so much.
Yeah, you can't learn it all. But let me clear the line with somebody else on. And they say when you start talking, of course, we've both seen the movie Mate One, probably more than once.
Well, that's where that music came from.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, Hazel Dickens was already more than famous long before that ever happened.
Yeah.
The reason I thought of Hazel was because it occurred to me that that might have been that vocal style you were talking about.
Yes, that's what it was. I had a grandfather who worked in PA. He started out as a Roman Catholic priest and married the housekeeper. My kind of guy, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I can understand him a lot because of that. But, those folks were mostly Austrian miners in that area because, what it was all over Europe. Those folks they brought into Matewan, were they what nationality were?
Well, Matewan is kind of a composite story. The characters in Matewan are composites of real life human beings, but the history was that when the way it worked out, and I think we discussed this a little bit before, but not in much detail. The way it worked out is once the people who had lived on the land got dispossessed, and this, it wasn't by accident, got dispossessed of their homes by virtue of things like broad form deeds, then they had a choice. They could starve to death, or they could go to work at slave wages for the coal industry.
Yeah.
So they went to work. And eventually people looking for work in a boom, coal is nothing. Coal is like any extractive industry. Whether it be tar sands or fracking or gold mining or whatever, there's no middle ground. It's all boom or all bust. And so when the boom was on, people came from all over to work because there were jobs. It was part of the, we talk about, things that happen in, urban settings. Well, there was a very real, and Joe Bajant writes about it at some length in Rainbow Pie, there was a de-ruralization of America as well. And the coal boom in Appalachia was part of that. So when the folks who had come in began to grow tired of the way they were being treated by the coal industry, they were among the ones that the young United Mine Workers sought to organize.
Yeah.
And as well, there were people who were, for instance, the sons and grandsons of freed slaves. Remember, the first coal miners in the United States were slaves.
Yeah.
And if you want to talk about being left in a pit to die, that's where you start. Jeff Biggers has written fairly extensively about this. Horrible circumstances and, hell on earth. So when those groups began to, and the United Mine Workers was formed from its very outset as an integrated union, because everybody's the same color in the dark.
Yes, sir.
And when you die the same horrible death.
Yes, sir.
And when you're being victimized by a corporation, they're not victimizing based on race, they're victimizing based on social and class status. So when the people who had originally worked the mines began to try to organize and rebel against their brutal conditions, strikebreakers were brought in.
Well, of course, that's the first thing, yep.
And the strikebreakers were generally immigrants from Eastern Europe, but also Italy. I mean, there's a huge Italian population, huge for West Virginia, by West Virginia standards, huge Italian population in northern West Virginia up around Clarksburg.
Okay.
And they were brought in as strikebreakers. And then they organized until, you know, everything culminates with the Battle of Blair Mountain, the great futile act of rebellion that was squashed and destroyed labor organizing for another decade and a half, until FDR came into office and with a willing Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act. That was what made the difference. For anybody out there who says that it's futile to try to work through government to bring about social change, all I need do is point to the National Labor Relations Act. You know, that's why we're trying to get the AIC Act through Congress, because with all love and admiration and respect for people who are willing to go to jail for civil disobedience, for people who are willing to march, rally, protest, what have you, that brings about the awareness of the issue, but then ultimately something has to be done within the structures of government to take it forward. And that was, you know, that's how you get the National Labor Relations Act, and that is how we hope we will get the AIC Act bill. There were literally people shanghaied, and we know that that word has a real meaning going back to like Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, on the West Coast it was.
And San Francisco and Seattle. But people were shanghaied who had gotten off the boat in New York City or Philadelphia, and they said, "You want to go to Brooklyn?" This is a true story. "Oh, yes, I'd love to go to Brooklyn." You know. Well, they were put on a train and brought to a little coal camp on the edge of the New River here in Fayette County called Brooklyn.
Oh.
And hence that story we talked about a few weeks ago about the one mine disaster that killed 70 people about 10 miles from here. There was a bit of a mystery because the Italians in the mines were known to carry their money in gold on their persons at all time. And lo and behold, the dead Italians didn't have any gold on their persons.
Yeah, I wonder why.
God, gee, you know, funerals are expensive. They were probably just charged in advance, right?
Well, that's the last racket we're subjected to, yes. Jesus.
But, I mean, that's the history around here, and that's... And if you've got any real appreciation for that history, then you can't help but be mightily offended that there's some amusement park company out there that wants to make $32 a head. I'm not kidding. $32 a head off of people wandering through a maze that is populated with spooky dead miner body parts.
Well, that's the bunch that runs the one up in Sandusky, isn't it?
Yep, the very same.
Yeah, see, I grew up with an amusement park within the city of Cleveland, which had one ride, Bob. It was a bobsled ride, and it was on casters, and you ran the walls in that thing. But there was no safety devices because somebody was going to come in and rebuild it. But to be able to jump on a city bus and go to an amusement park that had no admission charge, I had a lucky childhood in that respect, that's for sure. Because that was a whole different... We never went to the place up on the west end of the estate. Now that's where the big money is now. And, of course, you can't even have a fun house anymore because you're afraid somebody's going to sue you.
Right.
I'll leave you with a laugh. There was a fun house at this Euclid Beach Park that had a hollow tree. And inside it was a papier-mâché owl on a spring-loaded of some kind. And if somebody did something a few rooms back, this owl would pop out. Well, one guy was like me, maybe too inquisitive, and he had his face up there. And the owl came out and broke the poor guy's nose. But if in the 1930s, he probably didn't even sue anybody, you know. That's the way things were. Nowadays, you know. But I mentioned the guy from West Virginia who came up to either was the B&O, or the C&O Railroad, and he seized the damn offices. And he was armed to the teeth, and he eventually went to jail, unfortunately. But I guess they did make good on the settlement, finally. But why was he so angry? Because they tried to screw him. And believe me, it's like what kills me about health insurance people who are so against single payer. I always remind them of when they got their car totaled, how angry they were at the insurance company. And I've got a question that I wish people would comment. I've never seen, Bob, in my life, I have never seen or heard more damned automobile insurance commercials on either radio or television than they run today. It seems every other commercial is to sell you some kind of insurance.
And isn't it interesting? Do you remember when everything was like a good neighbor is there? And
yeah.
You're in good hands with, Well,
yeah.
Have you noticed that they've given up on that? Because I guess the American people aren't buying anymore. So now we get a woman in white with bright red lipstick, or we get an animated CGI lizard.
Yeah. And all I remember growing up with car insurance is when you were male, until you were 27 years old, they wanted $700 for liability yearly. So most of us, we look the other way.
Oh, I have a shocking insurance premium, and I haven't had a wreck or a ticket in years.
Well, I had a guy wipe my car out and from behind, and I wasn't going to sue anybody, Bob. But then they tell you to go out and buy a car that's in good a shape as yours, and they'll give you the wholesale price of the car. Wait a minute, your guy hit me from behind at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. He was going 40.
Oh, believe you me, it'll be 2 years on December 30th that my lovely wife and our son were rear-ended by a local pillhead.
Oh, fun!
When they were sitting still, and my the rusty red pickup truck was sent to its long home, and the repercussions of that have not ceased since.
Oh, it hurts when it happens.
I mean, it may not have looked real good, and I don't think the Chrysler Corporation has yet to really nail down the art of clear coat. But it ran like a top.
Well, like painting cars today is an art form. Hell, I learned how to paint cars when I was 20 years old with enamel and lacquer, but you can't do it anymore in your backyard.
Oh no. No.
Even if you have a good compressor and a good gun, and the person you're working with is a professional, it's really.
Oh no, no! You got to bake it in an oven and stuff like some sort of Christmas goose.
Well, they're giving you the goose, all right, but it doesn't seem to cease. And we talk about television. The stuff on that boob tube is ridiculous. It's reached a new low as far as what was the deal about the Amish people having their own mafia? What the hell was that about?
Geez, I can't even begin, Bill.
Who buys this stuff? Who believes this crap? I mean, sure, I imagine there's a few people that belong to anything in the world, and if you're a dishonest person, you're a dishonest person, but it's not a... Last I looked, it wasn't a syndicated thing. There used to be a group of people, the Williamson clan. You ever hear of them?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, they used to operate out of your state, and they'd come up in the spring, and one of their specialties was recoating your driveway.
Oh, really?
At a reasonable, cheap price, and it was a good deal to them.
Oh, they'd really do it?
Yeah, they'd do it, but when it rained, you saw your new, fresh driveway coating running into the gutter. I had a guy hit on me one time about he was going to do body work on my car, and I'm sitting in a restaurant eating, and the guy tries to sell me the job, and luckily for me, I knew too much about how that work is done. I had too many friends who did it for a living. I was like, go lie to somebody else, you know. Not that I haven't been taken to the cleaners now and then, Bob, by people. But we all can get...
Oh, we've got windows in this house that prove that we were taken to the cleaners.
Well, home remodeling can be another racket. Aluminum siding, vinyl siding, aluminum siding, windows. It just depends on the honesty of the people involved, and my friend, you roll the dice with a TV repair. I can tell you stories
about this TV repair man you knew.
Yeah, well, what people told me, what they had paid for jobs, and the one woman, she bought a rebuilt filter capacitor, which were...
A rebuilt what?
Filter capacity. Those metal cans that used to be in the back of a TV.
Oh, okay, okay.
And as far as I never knew, they didn't rebuild the things.
Right. Yeah, I thought you were going to tell. I thought you were going to tell me that she bought a brand new Knutton valve.
Well, just about it. I mean, well, what people used to do is they'd scarf up used TVs and strip a lot of the parts out and then stick them in the next job. Just depended to who you were dealing with. Me, I was half honest because I didn't really care about it. It was just a sideline with me, just something to do and something to amuse myself with, you know.
Yeah, kill time between gigs.
And my overhead was like, you know, what an old station wagon was my overhead. And I used that for music, too, for many years to transport that.
Yeah, now try to work on a flat screen.
Oh, yeah, I will. Hand me the shotgun. I'll fix it right now. Anyway, you take care of yourself.
Bill, you have a good night. I'm glad we got the phone problems sorted.
Take care.
Bye now. Mr. Stress, Bill, calling from Cleveland. Let's keep rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Kevin. What's happening?
I wanted to call in because you and Bill were talking about that movie that Hazel, was it Dixon, played in?
Hazel Dickens, yeah. Mate Juan.
Yeah. Say that again?
Mate Juan. M-A-T-E-W-A-N.
Oh, I've never seen that. Never heard of it, for that matter. So.
Well, you're in for a treat then.
Yep. Well, you know, it's funny how that goes because people want unions, and some of these old union people are now voting Republican. It just boggles my mind how, you know, 40, 50 years ago they were all union, pro-union, but now they bought into the Republican lie, and you can't convince them otherwise of, you know, how unions are somehow evil.
Oh, I remember back 8 years ago, more than, when we were getting the phone system. And the internet system put in, and I had a, we had the funny guy, and...
Yep.
And sat there and said, I cannot tell you how many trucks that are, you know, they go back to the central office. He said, I cannot tell you. Got in to truck A, truck B, truck C, truck D. I can't tell you how many of those trucks are tuned over to the channel, to the radio station that runs.
Yep. No, it would affect me or horn listeners, but it makes wonder if you listen to the same stuff day in and day out, don't start to believe it.
It rots your brain.
It must, because...
Well, if you don't have, and this is the kind of thing Dr. Bill talks about, Kevin, if you don't have the critical skills necessary to be able to tell when you're being fed a line of crap,
yep,
then you're likely to believe it. And that's why Rush Limbaugh never debates. That's why... You know, the only debate Hannity ever had was with that poor little human doormat, Alan Colmes.
Yep.
And why he never got a word in edgewise.
Yep.
And that's why if they are they immediately start screaming.
Yep. Well, no, immediately, whatever the issue is, they immediately start raising a hue and cry if you say anything against that issue. It's like, I forget where I saw it, but they were talking about an exercise in college where you wrote Jesus on a piece of paper.
And oh, God, yeah.
And, you know, how that was kind of to show how symbols do have a lot of meaning to you.
Right. The point was never to have anybody step on Jesus. It was about one's willingness to do that. And see, that's the difference. You know, you had that weirdo little fundy who said, I ain't a-gonna step on the name of my Lord and Savior. Whereas if it's me, I'm gonna write, okay, can we write Moses and Muhammad and Allah and Buddha? And you know, the funny thing is the Buddha's the only one that would go, oh no, write my name twice. Kill the Buddha. Please.
Yeah, and, you know, even in my ultra-religious days, which for me weren't all that ultra-religious, but even in those days, what the heck does it matter? It's a lesson to show you the power of symbols, not to have you actually stomp on it. And it wouldn't have mattered one whit to me, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In terms of the lesson, but these Sundays are raising a hue and cry, and supposedly Rick Scott actually went to the trouble of passing a law saying that this couldn't be taught in, not high school, but college.
Never mind the constitutionality of that.
Right, yeah.
But see, constitutionality doesn't matter anymore in America. And the, you know, the person, let's say Rick Scott, for instance, goes to his constituency, the little teabaggers and weirdos, right-wingers, or pig-lickins and whatnot, and says, listen, I know you didn't like it, but this is America, and it's one of the things that we pay for. It's one of the things that we deal with in order to have free speech, you know. So you people can go to rallies and wave signs that say, we're bringing our guns next time. Okay, because there are a lot of people that find that really offensive, too. But you do it. So, but do you realize that the teabaggers and whatnot would tear him limb from limb if he said that? And they'd call him a rhino and a traitor. And
that's why I turned on Charlie, because he hugged Obama. You know, that's
And now, you mean Christie?
No, Charlie Crist, the former
governor. Okay, well, they're doing this to Chris Krispy Kreme now.
Yep.
Because he's had to put out a statement from his press flag now saying, that was not an actual hug. I have never hugged that in my life.
Yep. Yeah, I saw that. But, you know, I'd have a lot
when of... He crawling, when he was probably jumping up in his arms, like Gilligan jumping in... ...the skipper that was a year ago when Sandy hit.
Sure, because I'm bringing gifts to my good and great boy, you know, bringing money to the state. But that money.
But Chris Christie has presidential ambitions, and he is being whipped left and right by people like Ted Cruz, who's obviously spending all of his damn time in Iowa. And Chris Christie just knows that he doesn't have a chance in this country without the teabaggers, without the people who say, "Get your government hands off my Medicare."
Yeah. Or like that woman in the Washington Post who wrote that article about not only one that wrote the article that you were talking about, but this wrote an article about Obamacare was because Medicare were okay, paid into it.
You noticed.
And I thought, you know, that's somehow amazing, because those are the same people that before Obamacare became the law, they were saying, keep your hands off my Medicare, not realizing that that's government funded too, you know? And that's the sort of low information people you get, which unfortunately, seem to be the minority now, or the majority now, instead of the minority.
And see, the other thing that bears mentioning is that this upstanding fine patriot woman in North Carolina who thinks here in and security okay because she died for it. She's going to take a lot more out of that system, by God.
Yeah, and she objects. The one you read about the farmer against the elderberry farmer, she doesn't realize that for that farmer to go get a job doing something else is probably going to pay less than his $20,000 a year he's getting on the elderberry farm, you know, and then it's okay for him to take Obamacare or health care of any kind because he takes a job that pays less. And that's the stupidity of it. These people don't realize that you're getting a subsidy if you don't make a certain amount, but you're still paying monthly premiums of some kind. You're not getting it, quote-unquote, for free. And then for the young people that are in the system, they're probably not going to get sick. So who are they paying for? They're paying for you and me. You know, and that's the way it's always going to work, because the young pay for the older, and those young kids, those kids that are young now in 30, 40 years, they're going to be the elders, and I imagine they're going to be looking around going, where's our health care?
Right, but who was this horse's ass from the Obama administration today? Gene Sperling, who declared that the Democrats are just going to have to eat some entitlement cuts.
Well,
I mean, that went through me like a dose of damn salt, Kevin.
Oh, yeah, just Gene Sperling, the Dick Durbin up in Illinois has said that, and, you know, I just, whenever I get the chance, I tweet out something like, if you're a Democrat and you vote for any type of entitlement reform, quote-unquote entitlement reform, you're not getting my vote ever again for anything, and that ought to be the way we treat them. If the president agrees to any kind of entitlement reform, in my opinion, he destroys whatever legacy he has with Obamacare. Because you're giving us something on one hand and taking much more away with the other.
But I remind you, and this goes back to the Libboat cruise of some years back, it'll be, good God, 3 years in February, late January. One of the guests on that progressive cruise was Alan Grayson.
Yep.
Who told us publicly that he had had a conversation with Barack Obama, and that in that conversation he asked him, what is your heart's desire? If you could fix one thing, you know, the beauty pageant question.
Right.
And the things that come to mind, you know, world peace, two-state solution in Israel-Palestine, end nuclear proliferation, having normalizations with Iran, end the embargo with Cuba. How about ending hunger in America? Or stopping global warming? No. None of those things. And if I recall correctly, Alan Grayson said he didn't even miss a beat. He said entitlement reform.
Yep. Well, it just...
At the time, that gave me the chills.
Sure. And it needs to be something that rank and file Democrats need to bite and scream all the way to the bitter end of it.
And apparently some, at least more progressive types, are doing that. Bernie Sanders is hollering, no, hell no. Howard Dean has been hollering, no, hell no.
I can't tell you how many petition things I got this weekend just on that one subject.
Oh, speaking of petitions, I need to make something known, Kevin. I'm glad you said the word. For anybody who is severely put off by that nasty ass story about the miners' revenge maze,
yep,
there are two petitions. One by a Beckley, West Virginia resident named Hannah Stanford. And she says, the tragic death of any coal miner is not a laughing matter, and it is definitely not something that needs to be used as a theme park attraction. This heartbreaking reality is life-changing for many people, and to use it for business promotion is completely distasteful. And these are both at change.org. And Ellen Smith of Pittsford, New York, also authored one. She says, I'm all for Halloween fun, but this King's Dominion attraction is absolutely unacceptable. With families and mining employees still trying to recover emotionally and financially from recent disasters, this attraction is outside the limits of integrity and morality. It is beyond the bounds of good taste. It surpasses standards of decency.
Sure does. And that's the biggest thing I find about these teabagger types. They have absolutely no class. They don't mind taking something, which my thoughts, when I first heard about it, went immediately to that Upper Big Branch mine disaster, just like that, when I first read the story, because that was the latest mine disaster, or at least the biggest one that you could think of, that kind of fit with that, and you know it was based off that. At least I think so. And there's not enough made-up stuff that you can't do something about. You got to make it off a real-life disaster with people that are still living, you know. It just... But if they did something like that off, say, a real-life story of a child being kidnapped, let's say, and killed, people would be raising their fists right and left over that. But it's okay to do that over 29 minors that were, as you say, incinerated, you know, in an instant, and that's okay. And I don't get it. I just don't understand it. So, yeah, anybody that can, go sign those petitions, because these people have no taste, class, or anything else. And
and I've posted links to both petitions in the chat room for anybody who wants to go and have a look.
Good. I think you should be able to go to change.org's homepage, though. And
yeah, you probably can. Just go and look for King's Dominion.
Yeah. So, do you know the Hannah Stafford woman from Beckley?
No, I do not.
Hmm.
I got it, but I got news of this early this morning from anti-mountaintop removal activists.
Yep.
Because, it's one thing. It is one thing to oppose. I mean. I don't know how to put it, Kevin.
Well, I think the best way to put it, Bob, is that while you oppose mountaintop removal of any kind, and while you generally oppose any coal mining of any kind, you're very much pro-safety for the miners. And I think we're all for that. If there's going to be mining and there's going to be miners, we at least ought to make those conditions safe for them. To where when an accident like Upper Big Branch happens, that the next one won't happen because of the safety that's built into the system, which wasn't followed by that particular mine. And while Don Blankenship, I think, was he the owner of that one?
Well, he wasn't the owner. He ran Massey Energy, and yeah.
Yep. Well, my point is the people that went to jail were kind of lowered down the food chain figures. One of them was the foreman. So, you know, they never get the top guy because, you know, that foreman and the other guy were just following the directions of the owner.
Well, that's what makes it special. This is not an attempt just to take down the piss ants. This is starting at the bottom and working their way up, because if you look at the other people, it has been a steady climb up the ladder.
Yep. Yeah, but I just wonder if they'll ever get to the top of that ladder. That's what concerns me, because it's guys like Blankenship that profit at all costs. If there's a worker killed, you know, we extend our condolences, and that's it. And that story you read about $70 they gave the families back in
the... Yeah, that's the Monongah disaster.
Yeah, and I figure, what, in today's dollars, that's maybe $3,000? You know, so put it in today's dollars, it's still not worth anything. You know what I'm saying?
And then, of course, the remark of the coal executive, well, that ought to make them a pretty nice Christmas.
Yeah. How, you know, again, that's the class of these people. And when you don't, you're called a psychopath or a sociopath if you're a killer that kills wantonly and without discrimination of any kind. But if you're a coal miner executive who lets your people die because you didn't follow safety rules, that's called capitalism.
Right. And it's also called how to be a millionaire.
Yeah.
There's a very much infamous memo authored by Don Blankenship that was introduced in court in the Aracoma disaster case in which he told people, we are not in the safety business, we are in the coal mining business. And if you're not running coal, you're not working. Work like you mean it. And if you and then just go and read up on the causes of the Arizona fire and it,
how do you spell that?
A-R-A-C-O-M-A.
Yeah, that's easy enough. I was just reading the other night about the Texas City, Texas disaster back. I think it was like 1947.
Right. When that whole area blew up.
Yeah. And the internet is definitely good for that because
I guess they hadn't had an explosion quite like that until West Texas went up, the fertilizer factory there. Last year.
That'd be about the only thing I could think that would be even close to it. I mean, you're talking people, though, that they never found. Bodies, nothing. They never found them. And we're not talking about people who got blown overboard and into the sea. We're talking about people
who got incinerated.
Incinerated. Bob, I worked in the funeral industry. Do you know what it takes to completely incinerate a body, bones and everything? It's very, very hard to do. When you cremate someone, the bones are left. And that's what the ashes are in reality, is the dried out bones.
Yeah, ground up.
Yeah. So to actually incinerate someone to the point that nothing is found of them, that heat has to be tremendous. Just, you know, off.
Well, imagine the explosive force. And, of course, they didn't think about this when they came up with their little $32 a head profit-making scheme at King's Dominion. But imagine the explosive force it takes to propel the entire body of a human being into the ceiling of a stone ceiling.
Yep.
Of a coal mine.
Yeah. And I still, I'm almost speechless with them doing this off the dead bodies of miners. It just blows my, you know.
Well, at this rate, I expect next year they'll do an encore with, I don't know, maybe they can recreate the Virginia Tech campus in a maze 70 miles south of Washington, D.C., and make $32 a head off of the Virginia Tech shooting.
Well, you know that the little teabaggers would be protesting over that one because that would be showing the violence of guns, and they don't want to do that. You know, there's a story in the Denver paper today of a little three-year-old that was found dead, and I guess they found the gun later, and that's the cause of death of this little three-year-old. They don't know how it happened, if she was shot or shot herself or whatever, but, you know, how many times a day, if you perused all the newspapers in America, would you find a story like that? It happens probably at least once a day where some kid accidentally shoots himself. That's aside from the, you know, what, 50 states, probably 100 murders a day, if not more, by guns. But we don't want to do anything as sensible as background checks because that might actually stop some of it.
Can't have that. We wouldn't be free anymore.
Well, we'd still be free to own a gun. You'd just not be free to
own
a gun.
Well, and remember, that's the real definition of freedom, Kevin.
I guess so, but not the freedom I'm interested in.
Not freedom to eat a nutritious meal or freedom to express. No, the only freedom that matters in America is, you know, guns.
Guns,
God, and guts made America great.
Yep.
I've seen that on the back of more rusted out pickup trucks than I can count.
Well, yeah. Try to talk to them about history, though, and I bet your version of American history is a little bit different than theirs.
Oh, not even worth the attempt.
No, because they'd be looking at you like, what are you talking about? That's not American history. That's not what I was taught. So, just very sad. I don't know. It just at some point begins to really grind on your nerves with the classlessness of these people and people like Ted Cruz. I'm figuring that was probably a $5,000 a plate dinner or $500 a plate dinner at least, multiplied by 600.
I don't know. It was Fundy's. They may have just passed a plate.
No, I tend to see at the times they've come through here with the Fundy fundraisers, it's generally around $500 a plate. That's, I rarely ever see them pass the plate at that kind of thing. They usually got a set fee for it. So I would be willing to bet it's probably about $500 a plate, but what? The next presidential election's in 2016, it's 2013. What are you up fundraising for 2016 now for? You know, and we all know the answer to that with Ted Cruz, because that's all he cares about.
Because the early Cruz gets the worm.
Right, yeah, well, I kind of hope they nominate somebody like a Cruz Palin ticket or something, because, you know.
For America.
Yeah.
Cruz Palin, for America.
That's right.
Or maybe Cruz Rubio. Wait. Bush Cruz. Cruz Santorum. My God, this is like trying to pick lottery numbers. The possibilities are almost endless.
Yeah, I say I'd be thrilled if they picked Ted Cruz as their nominee, but quite frankly, I couldn't stand it. I'd end up, you know, that would be one of the tennis balls in the mouth, duct tape around, and running off into the hills.
Yeah.
Kind of moment.
Barking yeah. Like a... Yeah, I know. Kevin, good to talk to you.
All right, Bill, you take care.
All right.
Or Bob, I'm good.
That's fine.
On my mind.
We both will.
Take care.
Bye now.
All right.
Bye-bye. Kevin calling from Colorado Springs. Lines open 304-658-3333. Oh, no. Up with that, I will not put Marty. Marty just emailed Cruz Cheney, 2013. No, that's a dick too far. Hey, welcome to the program.
Wayne.
Oh, hey, Jim.
I want to ask you a question. During this encounter that you had with Grayson,
mm-hmm.
who talked with Obama about entitled reform,
mm-hmm. It wasn't an encounter I had with him. He was speaking to a whole room full of people.
Well, whatever. I mean, did he elaborate?
What do you mean? He talked about the conversation that he had.
I mean, did the president elaborate on the specifics of entitlement reform?
Not that I recall, no.
Well, that's one thing to say, but if you don't elaborate on how you're going to do it, I mean, that's really questionable.
What do you mean?
Well, if you bring out a topic like that and you don't support it with, you know, specifics on how you're going to do it, then it doesn't exist.
Well, I guess we can sit and wait and see if it exists.
In a meeting, that you were in a meeting or some type of confab or whatever you were on that cruise, and Mr. Grayson brought that up, that was Obama's chief objective, then surely to God he would have relayed to Mr. Grayson how he intended or what he would like to have done.
I don't think one necessarily flows from the other, Jim.
I do.
But it was simply a matter of, you know, like I said, the beauty pageant question. What's the one thing you want to do? Entitlement reform. Boom. Done.
Well, a beauty pageant is one thing, government's another. And when you make a statement like that relayed to you by a second person or whomever as to what the president said he wanted to do, I would like to know what he meant by doing it and the steps.
Well, what does entitlement reform mean to you, Jim?
Well, I don't know. It means a number of things. But, I mean...
Well, we can we do the Sherlock Holmes thing and eliminate the impossible?
We can't exactly examine what's in Obama's mind when he made that statement. Of course, knowing the president, he could have shifted to something else entirely different as his primary objective.
Well, he didn't say it was his primary objective, Jim. It was simply related as, well, you know, his heart's desire.
Do more than anything else. To me, that intimates
a primary objective. We can say, for instance, that entitlement reform probably doesn't mean lowering the Social Security retirement age to 55, which would actually be intelligent. That it probably doesn't mean lowering the Medicare eligibility age to 55. I think we see a little bit of so-called, if you want to use that rubric, entitlement reform in the idea of trying to expand Medicaid in all 50 states, but that got shot down by the smartest Republican in the United States, John Roberts. Because that, you know, the states that have the Medicaid expansion inside the Affordable Care Act are going to have a significantly higher threshold for eligibility for Medicaid than they had before. Places like West Virginia, Kentucky.
What would that threshold be?
Well, there was, prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, there was asset testing inside Medicaid. So if, for instance, you were a single male with no kids working a minimum wage job 30 hours a week and were, in essence, poor as Job's turkey, but you had one of those aforementioned rusted-out pickup trucks to drive and a cardboard box to live in, you were too rich for Medicaid. Now the asset testing is gone.
I mean, that's not going to be a factor.
Right. It is going to be income-based only.
Okay.
Now, the income requirements are still not exactly generous, 137% of the poverty line.
Okay. And in dollars, what would that be?
I think for a family of four, it's something like $30,000 a year.
Okay, and if you go beyond that $30K, what happens?
You're into the exchanges.
Okay.
You're into the for-profit healthcare system.
So that's basically where you're going to find yourself. Is that what you're telling me?
I have no idea. There's no way I should be in the $30,000 neighborhood.
Well, I just wondered exactly what he meant by that, and surely he would have given certain bullet points or something.
No, like that. You can't say something like surely. It was just a brief conversation. That's the way it was related. It wasn't like they were in a conference committee or something. But I think we can get a hint by virtue of what Gene Sperling has said. Now, this is the president's advisor, and he said today that the Democrats are just going to have to eat it on entitlement reform.
Well, they probably will. I would dare say, given the political climate in Washington today and the types of things that people are forced into in order to effect some type of compromise, or you can have a repeat of a couple weeks ago.
Well, the problem with using Social Security inside a rubric like entitlement reform is the fact that Social Security has nothing to do with either with the deficit at all. It's outside of it.
Well, they can make it inside real quickly. Let me tell you that right now. They can take anything they want to as far as pots of money are concerned and take from one and give to the other.
Darlene just wrote in, Jim. She said, don't forget, Obama constantly is putting Social Security on the table in trying to negotiate with the teabaggers in the House. Also, the changed CPI. He keeps rolling that one out, too. Uh-huh. This, of course, is total suicide for the Democrats, but Obama keeps offering it up. That's enough for me. And then I've got a link here from Ron and Raleigh to a 2008 debate in which President Obama calls for entitlement reform back then.
Well, apparently that's been in the back of his mind, and he's going to use that as a bargaining chip to deal with...
Right, and then there's all the talk of the grand bargain. Some people think it's 11-dimensional chess. Other people think that, you know, it's classic economic theory from the University of Chicago, you know, Milton Friedman's dead hand and all of that.
Well, there you go. There you have it. And I can guarantee you it will not mean anything. I mean, in other words, I think primarily in his mind is the law of the Obamacare and all the things that, you know, it entails. But, I mean, that's going to cost money. And where are they going to get the money to pay for it? That's what I'm asking.
I guess we wait and see, don't we?
I know where it's coming from.
Now, the teabaggers will tell you that it's coming out of their hides. But it's not coming out of Medicare. It's not coming out of Social Security.
But let me say to you this. How do you know these funds are fenced? In government, we have certain things that are fenced that can't be touched. But it would appear to me, when you put everything on the table, the fences are no longer there.
Well, and that goes all the way back to when Dim Leader went to Parkersburg, West Virginia, Jim, and declared that the public debt was nothing more, and these were his words, not mine, than a worthless bunch of IOUs.
Well, he's probably right, because they borrowed so much from the Social Security Trust Fund that, you know, that could very well be true.
I remember in 2000 when he laughed at Al Gore for suggesting that the...
A lockbox.
Yeah, laughing over the lockbox. No. Exactly.
Well, I mean, Al Gore, I think, knew what he was talking about. And what I'm telling you is, when it comes to these people doing their grand bargain, there are no fences that guard anything.
Right, and the grand part and the bargain part are not with respect to anybody who ever hopes to collect Social Security, without a doubt. And then Gene Sperling. But the right wing may be stupid enough to, you know, keep doing what they're doing, so we'll just maintain stasis. Jim, good talking to you.
Likewise.
All right. Bye now. And here is about 3 minutes past 8 o'clock, and I've got, I think, our old buddy Matt Osborne on the line. Are you there, Matt?
I am right here.
Okay. You're on the Skype line, so I'll tweak as we go and try to make sure you've got a real good audio, or as good audio as we can possibly have under the circumstances. You've been doing some actual, real, live, no kidding, honest to God journalism, haven't you?
Well, depending on whether you ask my critics, of course, people who don't like what I write will tell me that it's not journalism. They can't really say what it is. But I don't call myself a journalist. I occasionally commit acts of journalism, and that is what I have been doing. I've been pursuing this very weird, very strange story now since the death of Andrew Breitbart last year. I'm sure you remember that.
Remember it? We celebrate it every day.
Yeah. The problem is that when somebody like that dies, there are always going to be those people around them who proclaim themselves to be the ones carrying his true mantle. And so they...
Is this that Monty Python scene with follow the gourd, no follow the shoe?
Something like that, yes. Yeah. Something similar to that.
And it seems crazy to use a name like Breitbart in the same sentence with leadership, but when he keeled over dead, whether, I don't know, was it crack, meth, what, I don't know. When he keeled over dead, though, there was a leadership vacuum, was there not?
There absolutely was a leadership vacuum, an instant leadership vacuum, because... Frankly, he had an authoritarian style. He ran the show. He surrounded himself with folks that made him look like the smartest person in the room. And you have to remember, he admitted that he was a C-plus student. So we're not talking about the brightest bulbs. And upon his death, a number of them decided to pick up this blog narrative that they had been attempting to cajole him into and proclaim that they were pursuing it in his memory. I'm speaking, of course, about the story of Brett Kimberlin.
Now this is going to take us a little while to march through. So let's get all the players on the playbill, Matt.
Sure.
Start with Brett Kimberlin. He is a bête noir of the right wing, correct?
Yes, he is absolutely the bête noir of the right wing. Mr. Kimberlin was convicted in 1979 of setting off some bombs in Speedway, Indiana. Some of your listeners may remember the Speedway bomber. Mr. Kimberlin maintained that he had not set off the bombs. Frankly, I don't know if he set off the bombs. He does admit that he was moving copious amounts of marijuana at the time. He was definitely pushing huge amounts of drugs. And Mr. Kimberlin served many, many years in prison. His appeal was taken up pro bono by the Republican lieutenant governor of Indiana because the conviction seemed so irrational. I mean, it was the last case in America. It was the last time that anybody in America was tried on the strength of testimony from hypnotized witnesses. Yes.
Okay, we're just going to let that blow right past, because otherwise I'm going to chew shoe leather.
Right. And this story begins in 1979. A lot of your listeners will remember Brett Kimberlin in 1988 claiming that he had sold marijuana to Dan Quayle. That's the same guy. When he finally got out of prison in the 90s, he got into the import-export trade, and he was in the...
Wasn't he in the first place? I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, sort of, yeah.
Sorry.
But he got into the legitimate import-export trade, and he traveled to the Ukraine, where he met a young woman named Tatiana. And she was apparently 17 when they met. She... apparently had some spark that he liked, as he told me in our phone conversation several weeks ago. He fell in love with this woman, and he fell in love with sort of someone who needed to be rescued. He felt like a white knight, of course, rescuing her from that situation. Because let's face it, in the 1990s, the Ukraine was probably one of the worst places you could live. So he brought her home with him and married her, and they have been living happily in Maryland until this year. What happened was that Mr. Kimberlin started running some nonprofits. One of them is called Velvet Revolution. You may know Brad Friedman, of course.
Sure, our buddy Brad.
Your buddy Brad Friedman is involved with Brett Kimberlin in Velvet Revolution, which is why these right-wing nut jobs have been proclaiming him, part of Brett Kimberlin's evil empire and so forth for the last several years. Really, to get to the modern story, you have to start with a...
Yeah, and just to be clear, all this deep background on Brett Kimberlin is not to in any way suggest that Brett Kimberlin is some sort of bad actor. He is, however, someone who has worked pretty tirelessly against the especially wacky end of the right wing in this country. Fair?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that is fair to say. He's been an activist contradicting the Chamber of Commerce. You may remember...
electronic voting issues.
Right. And so he's definitely an activist. For some reason, I keep getting asked this, why would these folks focus on this one obscure activist? And the reason is because, one of the reasons is that he's easy to caricature. I mean, it's, a convicted bomber. And if you have a...
Because William Ayers wasn't available. Right, got it.
Right, exactly. It's the William Ayers syndrome. And in fact, they have made some pretty insane attempts to try to link him to, Barack Obama and OFA and so forth and so on. 6 degrees of separation.
Well, they've tried to link him to the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, haven't they?
Well, if they haven't, they will. What really begins this is that in 2010, Mr. Kimberlin, his Velvet Revolution organization, there was an attorney for that organization who attempted to lobby the state's attorney in Maryland to file wiretapping charges against James O'Keefe. Remember the Acorn videos?
Right.
And the Baltimore Acorn video, of course, in Baltimore, Maryland, was made in violation of the wiretapping statute. So that effort happened in 2010, and there was a website, which I believe is still up. There's still a front page, indictbreitbart.com. Maybe it's .org. I don't remember right now. But if you go look for that site, you'll see it's still there. And so when that site appeared and when he made this effort to get James O'Keefe indicted, Andrew Breitbart decided to have his researcher, Mandy Nagy, also known as Liberty Chick, decided to have her dig up some dirt on Mr. Kimberlin. And that was easy to do because he has...
Yeah, it sounds like it'll take about 15 seconds.
And what she did was she cribbed most of her material from some blog posts that had been written by a guy named Seth Allen. Seth Allen is a cyber-stalking lunatic, certified lunatic, living in Massachusetts. So that's where this part of the story begins. We begin with the unique obsessions of a certified lunatic who is online all the time talking about chemtrails and other conspiracies. And this Seth Allen had convinced himself that Brad Friedman and Brett Kimberlin were some kind of conspiracy involving voting. It's not really clear to me what he was saying at the time because those blog posts had been taken down by Google. Mr. Kimberlin sued Seth Allen for defamation in 2011 for libel.
And Mr. Kimberlin does not hesitate to take recourse to the court system.
No, he does not, and he is definitely
for
litigated.
For pretty good reason as far as based on what I've read.
Well, yes. And Mr. Kimberlin took Seth Allen to court, and at this point, because Seth Allen's original material had become important to these folks, one of these Breitbart goons by the name of Aaron Walker decided to insert himself in that case. Now, Aaron Walker ran a blog that some of your listeners might remember. It was called Everybody Draw Muhammad. Do you remember that blog?
Oh, sweet Jesus.
Oh, no, sweet Muhammad.
Or in honor of Lou Reed, sweet Jane.
There you...
Yeah.
The Everybody Draws Muhammad.
I mean, this is a swamp, Matt.
It is a swamp. And draining this swamp to get at the truth is an incredibly difficult task. There is so much disinformation and misinformation involved. And in order to find out the truth, you have to drain so much muddy water. And it's almost impossible to 100% understand. You can't really drill down to an absolute truth. In some instances, there's just too much unknown.
Weird.
There's too much weirdness. But what we do know is itself very weird. We know that when he died, Andrew Breitbart had just a few hours before concluded a conference call with a couple of people based in New Jersey who were very interested in this Kimberlin story. And what they wanted to do was to drag Mr. Neil Rauhauser into the Kimberlin story, because the Kimberlin narrative is that Kimberlin employs Neil Rauhauser. This is not true. But the story is that he employs Neil Rauhauser to harass and intimidate right-wing bloggers. That's their narrative. So this has been going on for a little while. And if I step back to 2011, Aaron Walker inserts himself into the Seth Allen case prior to the death of Andrew Breitbart. And when he inserts himself in this case, he does so under his pseudonym. He's practicing law without a license in Maryland under a pseudonym. So run that by your little head checker right there. And give that the sniff test. Tell me what you think of that.
I feel like I've been drinking for the last 3 hours already.
There you go. So Mr. Walker, at some point, inserts himself, and not only does he insert himself by trying to advise Seth Allen, But he winds up going to Mr. Kimberlin outside the courtroom, grabbing the iPod out of his hand, and according to Mr. Kimberlin, hitting him in the head. Now, Walker claims that this is all a frame-up, that it's not true. The video that we have is, the security video, is not perfect. There's, a two-second delay between frames. So we're not actually seeing if there was a blow struck in those 2 seconds between frames. But Mr. Kimberlin goes to the hospital and claims that, he has been assaulted. And from that incident, Mr. Aaron Worthing is outed as Mr. Aaron Walker. So Mr. Walker is immediately concerned that he is going to be reported to Muslim terrorists by this evil bomber Kimberlin.
Huh?
Yes, what? That's...
Okay.
Because he's running this Everybody Draw Muhammad blog. And so what Mr. Walker does, he contacts his employer, and he tells his employer that this has happened and that we're all in danger because of Mr. Kimberlin. And at this point, his boss goes in his office and finds that the work that he has been paid to perform, the work that Mr. Walker has been paid to perform has been undone. It has been lying around in disarray. The office is filled with material related to Brett Kimberlin. So they fire him.
Okay, this is getting kind of stalky.
It is kind of stalky, and it gets even more stalky. We haven't even gotten to the real stalking yet. In fact, it's fair to call Mr. Aaron Walker Aaron Stalker.
Nice.
So, in February, just a couple months later, on February 29th, Mr. Breitbart is having a conference call with these folks who are trying to lobby him to adopt this Neil Rauhauser, Brett Kimberlin narrative. And part of this narrative is these SWAT calls. Do you remember the SWAT calls?
This is a sort of, and we're just going to use the word because the Nixon administration coined it. This is an episode of ratfuckery where people yes. would get the SWAT team called on them with some sort of crazy out there allegation that pick a crime, and it was always and it was directed again.
I will tell you this. The SWAT calls in question, these political SWAT calls, don't sound like regular SWAT calls. If you listen to the SWAT calls that result in actual SWAT teams showing up, they came out of the hacker community. There's some opacity there that I have not penetrated as to the origin of this bizarre hobby that some people seem to have. But what people do is they call and try to trigger police response to your address. So you're living at, 101 American Way. I call up and I say, yes, I'm calling from 101 American Way, and I have hostages, and I have a bomb that's full of nerve gas, and I have guns.
And no law enforcement agency can just blow that off.
Right. So if you listen to those SWAT calls, there's almost a Jerky Boys quality to them. They're actually just on the edge of ridiculousness. Who has VX nerve gas? Who has that? Not many people have access to that stuff.
Mostly governments.
Right. So this hobby that these people have involves getting the maximum police response out of a 911 emergency line. And the object is to frighten or scare some enemy of yours. In the hacker world, it could be as simple as somebody claims your little snippet of code that you created, so you swat them in revenge. Now, if you listen to the political swats, though, there's something very different about them. They are almost calm. They are almost minimal. The voice on the SWAT call says, yeah, I shot my wife. I don't know. She's in the bedroom, and
By the way, Agent Fred, these are recreations. This is a reenactment. This is not. We just say that because Agent Fred listens every night.
So if you listen to the political SWAT calls, they are a very different character. And as it happens, and this will become important to our narrative, The sound of the voice on those 911 audio tapes is suspiciously similar to that of Brandon Darby. Now, do you remember who Brandon Darby is?
Oh, God. No.
Brandon Darby. Better.
I've been following this for as long as you've been doing it, and I mean, the cast of characters just, you know.
Brandon Darby was the guy who, at the 2008 Republican National Convention, convinced a couple of progressive activists that they had not gone far enough, that they needed to do something more, that they needed to go over the edge and resort to violence. So they mixed up some Molotov cocktails, which they then sat around realizing, you know, maybe we don't want to do this. And Brandon Darby called his contact at the FBI because he was an FBI informant, and so the FBI swept in and...
Oh, God, yes, I remember.
Right. So these two young men were arrested, and, you know, right-wingers have been trumpeting that ever since as proof that we, Bob, we liberals, we are the real terrorists.
Yeah.
So Brandon Darby's kind of a hero to the right-wing dirt job, or right-wing nut job. He also was a friend of Andrew Breitbart. And Andrew Breitbart's employee, Lee Stranahan, it was Mr. Darby's podcast partner as of last year.
Oh, my God. Are we going into your foray into the... Oh, no.
I don't even know what you're afraid
no,
of.
Well, no. The night that Matt called the podcaster on the air who happened to be all liquored up?
That's a different...
Oh,
different
darn.
Story.
Okay.
Taylor. Who is tangential to all of this, but I don't think that it's necessary to discuss him in this context.
Okay.
The point is that when these SWAT calls first started happening in 2011, they were immediately blamed on, well, I've been blogging about Anthony Weiner. This is one of the people who was swatted was John Patrick Frey, the blogger known as Paterico, who by day is a Los Angeles assistant district attorney. And when he got his visit from the police, he proclaimed right away that it was because he had been blogging about Anthony Weiner. Weinergate had just taken place. But then, as the months passed, there was a new storyline. And the new storyline is that Mr. Anthony Weiner paid Brett Kimberlin to have Neil Rauhauser SWAT right-wing bloggers. Except that it doesn't sound like Neil Rauhauser on those 911 audio tapes at all. It doesn't sound like Brett Kimberlin either. It doesn't even sound like the person that Mr. Fry tried to blame, a journalist in New York by the name of Ron Briner. You know, this person did it on behalf of this person who did it on behalf of this person who did it on behalf of this person. And this ridiculous narrative, which, when I describe it, it sounds ridiculous. But by December of 2011, Mr. Fry was trying to get the FBI to investigate his conspiracy theory. And there are indications that there was actually FBI efforts to investigate accordingly. So you have, on the one hand, people who have blogs and who are doing this sort of public part that I'm about to talk about, and then you have folks in the back channel who are trying to get liberals arrested for SWAT calls.
All of which is just giant rat fuckery.
It is rat fuckery. It's just giant rat.
Not that I'm looking for a reason to use that word, but just to remind people who are, you know, if there are Venn diagrams, it's going to look like something done by, you know, a llama on meth with a light bright. This just blows my mind, Matt, because you've dug at it for years now, and I want to make sure that we get the whole story in, because this comes into the future in pretty shocking and chilling fashion.
Yes.
So let's try to work along those lines.
Right. I don't want to waste too much time on the ephemera and details. I just want to lay out the general picture so you can understand that when Breitbart died, He had these folks who were trying to get him to adopt this conspiracy theory. And when he died, you had the saner minds at Breitbart.com who were telling him, you should maybe not do this. Because by then he's already being sued by Shirley Sherrod. You remember what happened with Shirley Sherrod?
Yeah, she pushed back where Acorn didn't.
Exactly. And Shirley Sherrod's lawsuit proceeds, as a matter of fact. Now, when Breitbart died, he also had $10 million in venture capital funding. One of the sources has been reported as Aubrey Chernick. Who is Aubrey Chernick? I hear you cry. Get ready. Sit down. Aubrey Chernick is a right-wing Israel, pro-Israel reactionary who happens to also be a guy who's made his millions in the national security contracting world. I have reason to believe, I have a list of suspects who would be the other donor. One of my suspects is Aaron Barr of H.B. Gary. Some of your listeners will remember him. So, here's Mr. Breitbart with all this money, but he died without a will. And that means that Shirley Sherrod is going to be the beneficiary of most of these millions now.
One hopes.
And also Mr. Kimberlin may be a beneficiary of some of this money. We'll have to see how that plays out, but the point is that Mr. Breitbart died without a will. He did not leave his people with a clear direction to follow. So you have, on the one hand, the sort of editorial staff at Breitbart who have been trying to move away from this direction, and then you have folks like Lee Stranahan been adopting this crazy Kimberlin narrative whole hog. Are you hearing me right now?
Yes.
Are you
yes.
hearing me right now?
Yes.
Okay. I had a little hiccup there with the internet. Okay. Now, Mr. Stranahan proclaimed everybody blog about Brett Kimberlin Day last May. And everybody, all these right-wing reactionary bloggers began to write about Brett Kimberlin. And those writings are defamatory. A lot of the allegations in them reach back to 1979 and refer to things that were debunked in the grand jury testimony.
And a bunch of this stuff is just crazier than an outhouse rat.
It is crazier than a shithouse rat. And what happened was that in June, when Mr. Jason Wade Taylor came along, I was talking about Jason Wade Taylor, but all of these people were asking about Brett Kimberlin. Why on earth would anybody be trying to stick me and my friends in some little pigeonhole marked Brett Kimberlin? Why are you accusing us of working for Brett Kimberlin or knowing Brett Kimberlin or being on the side of Brett Kimberlin? Who is this guy? I had to ask my friends, who is Brett Kimberlin? I did not know. Nevertheless, that did not stop the conspiracy theory. So, as the year proceeded, 2012, this narrative did not diminish. Month after month, it gets bigger and bigger. And they are trying harder and harder and stretching things further and further to try and fit all this cast of characters within their conspiracy theory.
They're going to need a bigger shoehorn.
Now, come November, you would think that after the presidential election, that they might find something else to write about. I mean, after all, they have wasted a presidential election year writing about Brett Kimberlin, and in that time, they have not been able to knock down one single attack that Obama has made on his opponent. They have not been able to elevate Mitt Romney at all. They have not been able to attack Obama at all in any way that benefits Mitt Romney. So you would think that there would be some, I don't know, soul-searching, some reassessment. But no. After the election, it gets worse. And part of this story is that a man named Bill Schmalfeld, living in Maryland, he's a liberal blogger, he's 58 years old, and he's dying of Parkinson's disease. And Mr. Schmalfeld was blogging about all this stuff. So, at some point, folks on the other side decided that Schmalfelt must be working for Brett Kimberlin. So this
just
began,
out of the thin air.
So this began a phase in which they were filing criminal charges, peace orders, lawsuits against Bill Schmalfelt, thinking that they're going to get to Brett Kimberlin somehow. And just to show you how ridiculous this is, February 28th of 2013, they filed a peace order against Bill Schmalfelt and Brett Kimberlin at the same time to put them in the same courtroom so they could finally say that these two men had met.
Wow.
Oh, you haven't even gotten to the wow factor.
Oh, I know, but still.
So this has been going on. By the end of February, March, I have become part of this storyline myself because I've been blogging about all of this stuff. So the accusations fly at me. I'm not afraid to confront Aaron Walker on Twitter for a week and just pound him mercilessly until he blocks me. I'm not afraid to do that stuff. So I have to be incorporated somewhere into this conspiracy theory. And indeed, you know, I started seeing my name get incorporated. One of the groups that you have to know about in order to understand what's happening here is led by Ali Akbar. Who is Ali Akbar? Ali Akbar was a Breitbart.com blogger. In 2007, Ali Akbar was arrested and convicted of debit card fraud in Texas. He broke into a van, stole somebody's debit card, and used it. He was still on probation in 2012 when I first found out who he was. I did not know who he was until then. Akbar got involved in Tea Party politics before there was a Tea Party. He was out in Texas, and as soon as he was out of jail, he started involving himself in right-wing reactionary politics. In 2009, he was involved in the American Liberty Alliance, which is one of those Tea Party groups that sprouted up using Coke money and various, you know, other funding sources. In this particular case, it was run by the Sam Adams Alliance. So, you know, the owner of Sam Adams beer.
Jim Coke?
Right. So, he took this, job where he was basically running what claimed to be a non-profit organization and later, had to admit that it was not in fact a non-profit organization, that it had never filed for non-profit status. Organization was eventually rolled up into another one, so as a legal entity it disappeared off the map. But Ali Akbar continued in his career of fake nonprofit organizations. In 2012, at the beginning of 2012, he started the National Bloggers Club. And the National Bloggers Club claimed to be a 501c3 organization, or that was pending for that status. It has never applied, however. Ask Mr. Akbar for the EIN, the employer ID number of the National Bloggers Club, and he will scream at you and call you names and possibly have his employees file criminal charges against you, because Aaron Walker, Robert Stacey McCain, and William Hoag, the three characters that we're about to discuss, are all employees of Ali Akbar. Akbar has kind of set himself up as sort of the king of the right-wing reactionary blogosphere to some degree. He has ties in Alabama because he's worked for Republicans down here before. So he's got lots of connections. He's got a connection with Karl Rove. He's got a connection with Foster Freese, Mr. Aspirin Between the Knees.
My God.
So, yes, this man is linked to lots of folks. One of those folks is Dan Backer. Dan Backer is the Washington lawyer who created super PACs by suing the Federal Elections Commission. Mr. Backer, by the way, is currently just argued before the Supreme Court to have all campaign finance limits lifted, done away with, so that your billionaire can just give as much money as he wants to whoever he wants. And the best part is that he's also trying to make it legal to do that in bitcoins so that it will be completely untraceable and unaccountable. That's Dan Bakker. Dan Bakker is the treasurer of Ron Paul's Revolution PAC. When you start hunting around in right-wing Tea Party politics and look at the organizations, you will find his name all over the place. He's listed as treasurer and so forth. So here's Akbar with all of his connections and his little crew of bloggers, and he's taken on this Brett Kimberlin narrative, and anybody who questions him, who writes about him, who writes about the National Bloggers Club and the possible shenanigans going on, somehow they find themselves in for peace orders, criminal charges, lawsuits. Just somehow this keeps happening. Now, Mr. Akbar, his crew this summer had an opportunity of a lifetime as far as they were concerned. Mr. Kimberlin's wife is 35. She has two children. The youngest is 9. And 35-year-old women, married women with children of that age, sometimes, as we know, will do things like have an affair. And Miss Kimberlin had an affair with a man that she had met in Maryland. And when Walker and Hoag found out, they went to Maryland and offered Tatiana support for her divorce proceedings against her husband. And this support, of course, was conditional on the fact that they wanted her to perjure herself by basically endorsing all of this crazy conspiracy stuff that they had. They wanted her to say that he was the swatter. They wanted her to say that he had, you know, raped a 10-year-old girl in 1979 and that he had naked pictures of her that he looked at every day. Basically, they wanted her to portray...
Jesus, this is sleazy.
They wanted her to portray her lifestyle as being sort of similar to Ariel Castro's basement. And just to give you an idea of how crazy all of this is, Tatiana has been free all during her marriage to fly to the Ukraine if she wanted to. Oh, you want to take the kids to the Ukraine for a month? Go ahead. Oh, you want to go out of the country by yourself? Go ahead. She's always been free to do that. And so this narrative makes no sense. Well, Tatiana took part in this for a little while, for a period of a couple of weeks. But what happened was that Mr. Walker decided that it wasn't good enough. So not only did he write these documents and have her sign them, he also called the FBI. He called an agent named Dan Borsuk in Washington, D.C., and said, Brett Kimberlin has bomb material in his basement. Brett Kimberlin has been raping and torturing his daughters and his wife. And if you show up for her Child Protective Services hearing, I'm sure she'll tell you it's all true. So the FBI agent and a Baltimore detective showed up at the CPS interview where Tatiana was expecting to explain why she should get custody of her children. What message do you think that sent her, Bob? I'm just going to ask you.
Hey. Shut up?
Yes. Shut up and follow the line. Well, Tatiana decided that she was not going to cooperate. She left the scene without making a statement. The following Monday, she did her minimal business in court. There was a hearing. After that, she withdrew her perjured charges against her husband. Now, this just to give you an example of where this has gone, Mr. William Hoag, who, by the way, is a Church of Christ minister, reportedly.
Of course.
Of course. He decided that since Tatiana's perjured charges were going to be expunged, what he needed to do was to run to the courthouse and get a copy of these perjured charges and then publish them in his blog.
Wait, Wait, this kind of stuff is generally under seal, isn't it, Matt?
I know. It's very, very strange. It's all very strange. How did he manage to get that? I don't know. But the fact is that when they posted these charges on the Internet, they were basically repeating their own perjury as if it was proof of what they had been saying all along about this guy. And you can't do that. You can't get away with that in America. So Mr. Kimberlin is understandably suing them. And he's gone a step further. He has decided to sue all of these bastards who have been talking about SWAT calls and Brett Kimberlin. And, in fact, this narrative has managed to cross out of just the Breitbart world into Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck has had these people on. Just a moment. Glenn Beck has had these people on. And so that's one venue that has covered this Brett Kimberlin story in a defamatory way. No one ever contacts Brett Kimberlin for comment, you understand. No one ever... You know, they'll say, oh, this is the name of the girl that he supposedly raped in 1979, but they never call her to get her comment on this. Because that would be an act of journalism. And this is not journalism. This is not about telling...
No, this is the most bizarre... I mean, it sounds like, and I'm not trying to diminish the work you've done, Matt, and I'm not talking about the work you've done. I'm talking about the other side of this. Sounds acid fueled. I mean, this is don't eat the brown acid at Woodstock. You know, stomach cramps and leg cramps and breathing walls and paisley skies and Brett Kimberlin.
Yes, the amount of weirdness and bizarro world stuff that goes on in this story is just incredible. And digging down through the muck, you find things that you would rather not know. I am quite convinced that this narrative of Ariel Castro's basement is actually a wet dream of Robert Stacy McCain and Aaron Walker. And, you know, they're basically projecting their own sick fantasy on Brett Kimberlin and his family is what's happening there. There's a whole lot of precious bodily fluids type stuff in here. But the upshot of all this is that there's a RICO lawsuit that is separate from the lawsuit over Tatyana and the perjured charges. And these two lawsuits are a part of the story that I am now looking into. And just in the last week, I have obtained evidence that Mr. Robert Stacy McCain was in fact served. And you have to go back to May of 2012. Mr. Robert Stacy McCain, who was in a Southern Poverty Law Center's listed hate talker, Mr. McCain claimed that Brett Kimberlin was harassing him and that he was in fear of his life, so he had to leave his family. He didn't take his family with him. He had to leave his home and his family and go live in another state in a secure and undisclosed location. But I obtained evidence that Mr. McCain has, in fact, still been living in the same place. He's been lying about ever having to leave. He did not leave. He does come and go from time to time because apparently, from what I have heard, his wife can't stand the sight of him sometimes. So, you know, this guy has basically been lying to his readers, rattling the tin cup, give me money to defend myself against the horrible harassment of Brett Kimberlin, give me money so that I can fly to another state, but he never did. And Mr. Stranahan, too, has done the same act. Give me money because I'm being harassed, I have to leave my home, and then he never moves. So there's a fundraising fraud going on. And Mr. Akbar, his National Bloggers Club organization, it has never applied for 501 status, but has always, advertised itself, has solicited donations under the 501 rubric. So there's a fraud going on right there. He's a convicted fraud, and his employees are driving this narrative and doing all this stuff with Mr. Kimberlin in Maryland. So to me, what this sounds like is some folks desperately trying to make their story be true any way they can, because if they were to drop it, if they were to just let it go, then they would be stuck trying to explain why they did all this fundraising. And one of the purposes of the National Bloggers Club from the very beginning was, you know, to help bloggers to take on the harassment of Brett Kimberlin. It was all built into the narrative from the very beginning. So this is the story that I have been trying to cover or report on and investigate for a while. I have a book outline that I have been putting together. I believe that the Breitbart Empire and the group of people that were around Andrew Breitbart have collapsed into libel and defamation, and that all of that H.B. Gary, possibly, definitely, Aubrey Chernick money that Breitbart had is going to wind up going in the pockets of people who sue these assholes. So there's that. Some of your listeners are probably thinking, now, why is this important to me? Well, it might not be important to you. You may not care about Brett Kimberlin. You may not care about Andrew Breitbart. But to me, it is a story of people who have invented their way into a disaster. And you know how much I like Fiasco.
Well,
I
certainly,
love
but I think there's, also meaning elsewhere, Matt. And that is this.
Oh, yes.
There, to coin a phrase from long ago and far away, there really is a vast right-wing conspiracy. And I mean, this is a story of the obsession of one group of real chase them with a butterfly net Lulus who wind up with some Foster Freeze cash and run around spreading mayhem because they don't like somebody's politics.
And that
I think is a very valid story. And the way that this thing begins to dovetail into, and we've just got a few minutes left here, the way this thing begins to sort of semi-dovetail into the story of Roger Shuler, which needs to be told in full, because the man's still rotting in jail, right?
Right. At this hour, he is still in jail. Bob Riley has succeeded in making sure that
Riley, I'm the former governor of the state of Alabama, and Rob
yes.
Riley, and Rob Riley has attacked Roger Shuler, who goes under the blog nickname Legal Schnauzer, and is a graduate of the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which you don't get a degree from by mailing in a matchbook with Spunky the Parrot on the back. Has a journalism career in Alabama, a long career with the university system there, and got sick of watching the corruption in the state of Alabama, and has broken no small number of stories of said corruption, the latest of which happens to be, oh my God, the rent boy photo of a current sitting federal judge in the state of Alabama.
Yes, Bill Fryer, Alabama's former attorney general. The guy who wanted to ban sex toys.
Yeah, and the guy who did the screw job on Don Siegelman.
Yes, that guy. So this is the caliber of people that we're dealing with.
Yeah, who is by the way virulently anti-gay.
Yes.
And
I got exposed in a gay magazine.
Right, because I mean, when I say pictures of a rent boy, I mean full frontal nudity. Wow.
Rampant nudity, for that matter.
Okay, rampant. There's the word I was looking for. You know, the right wing is forever going on about gay sex, gay sex, gay sex. And on this program, at least, I try to channel our dear friend Peter Godbold, who asked once, why does it always have to be about the sex? Why can't it just be about love? Why can't it be about loving the person you're with and having a happy and decent relationship? And why has it always got to be about the sex? And I endorse that point of view. And we talk about it when the right wing comes out once again talking about, you know, what the gays do. And then along comes this photograph of a very young and probably impressionable Bill Pryor sitting totally naked and, as you put it, rampant in what was the name of the magazine? Bad Puppies?
Bad Puppies. Bad Puppy. which just, you know, speaks volumes right there. The name of the magazine tells you all you need to know. The reason why this narrative that we've been going over for 50 minutes comes into play here is because last week, on Wednesday night, Mr. Schuller was arrested, and I'm sure you've already told your listeners that story. And the next
we
day...
We haven't gotten there yet, no.
Haven't even gotten there yet, okay. I tell you what, since we're running out of time, I will say this. I would like to go down to Birmingham and get you on the air with Mrs. Schuller. What do you think about that?
That would be awesome.
I'd
like to talk to her because this thing has, I got to thinking, Matt, you know, because I didn't know anything about Bill Pryor and his love life. Not that I ever wanted to, but then I saw, you know, he was once Attorney General of Alabama, right?
Right.
And he was behind the no sex toys in Alabama.
Yes.
And he was succeeded by a guy by the name of Troy King, wasn't he?
Yes.
And I remember the parody that John Fox performed that I wrote about Troy King.
Yes.
Because Troy had, well, issues.
Yes, he did.
And once again, these are all closet issues. These are not issues related to whether or not somebody is gay. These are issues related related to whether or not somebody is a great big raving stinking hypocrite who will hurt people for political gain.
Exactly. And let's not forget also that Bill Pryor was the Attorney General in 2002, when it seemed, as everybody went to bed, that Don Siegelman, Democrat, was winning his race for governor against Bob Riley on election night. And the next morning we learned that, surprise, the numbers in Baldwin County had suddenly been changed, and Alabama's Attorney General Bill Pryor had sealed the ballots. They are still sealed.
Just like the court proceedings in the case against Roger Shuler are still sealed.
Exactly.
Now, it's 2013. We're running out of time, but it's 2013, Matt. A man has been taken into custody in the state of Alabama on contempt of court charges in a case that is being heard by a special judge who has basically imprisoned this man without access to bail, without access to counsel, in contravention of everything inside the United States Constitution and maybe inside Alabama's. And nobody can get a look at the proceedings to find out what the nature of the charges are.
Exactly.
Because this extends beyond the rent boy photos of a certain federal judge's wishfully forgotten past to the other episodes of what we here in the hills call romping among folks who ain't married to each other, who also at the same time happen to believe in traditional family values. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
And a guy is rotting in jail, having been first beaten by the police.
Yes, that is the totality of the situation. You have described the outlines accurately. I will say this before we run out of time. The reason why Ali Akbar comes into this is because last Wednesday, Shuler is arrested. The very next day, Akbar... decides to hold a podcast. He has a podcast on Blog Talk Radio. He doesn't do it on a regular basis. But he decided to hold a podcast, and he decided to get Bill Schmalfeld. Remember Bill Schmalfeld? I talked about him, the Parkinson's patient.
Yeah.
Decided to cajole him into calling his show. And during that call, he started asking Mr. Schmalfeld about a comment he had left about a story that he covered regarding Akbar and a link to Karl Rove that Roger Shuler covered over a year ago. It was in June of 2012 when Roger Shuler covered it. And suddenly, this becomes all important to Mr. Akbar. Mr. Akbar, who apparently is going to sue Mr. Shuler himself now, suddenly. It's so important that he clear his name with regarding Mr. Shuler. And Thursday night, Robert Stacy McCain, Akbar's employee, writes a nice blog post about me and Bill Schmalfeld in relation to that post last June by Roger Shuler. So what are they doing? What are they trying to do here? I'll give you my Occam's razor interpretation.
Please.
Mr. Akbar has lots of friends in the Alabama Republican Party because he's done a lot of work for folks down here. Mr. Akbar knew about Mr. Shuler's arrest before anybody had blogged about it and thought, gee, I should glom onto this situation because I can use it against my enemies. So that's what brings us to today.
Wow.
I would love to get down to Birmingham this week. I would love to put Ms. Shuler on the horn with you.
Do please. I want that story told because this is like, well, I mean, everything going on down there is contrary to every notion of a law, you know, nation of laws and not of men, equal justice under law. You know, we can run all the way back to the fields at Runnymede and talk about habeas corpus.
Yes. Yes. And remember who has been attacking habeas corpus all this time.
Oh, I remember very well.
So, yeah, there's a big story here, a big story to be told. Mr. Shuler, by the way, the 39th, ranked as the 39th most popular legal blog in America, and the only one in that list that is owned and operated by a single person.
Wow.
So, that for you. There's that for your discussion.
Well, thank you, Matt. I appreciate all the details. I got to roll out of here, but we're going to go into Roger Shuler's case in a little more depth, I think, tomorrow.
Okay.
And if you want to put her in touch with me, I would love to help, you know, shine a little light on this.
We will make that happen.
All right. You take care, Matt.
You too.
Bye now. You can follow him on Twitter at Osborne Inc., and you can read the whole Robert Stacey McCain bizarreness at osborneinc.com, the McCain mutiny, a Robert Stacey McCain burn notice, update X4. Trying to ruin people is a game to these right-wingers. A game. Just let that sink in. It's the same kind of thing that Andrew Breitbart did. Just trying to hurt people for the thrill of hurting them for some sick, twisted political ideology. Time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your kind contributions this evening. We raised $20, so that means we start tomorrow night with a fundraising goal of $280. We're back in the hole, but hopefully we'll get back out of it. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox, to Ben Birch. Thanks to you who keep all of this going with your kind contributions. And thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on the horn.